Where Murder Meets Mystery contains graphic and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, Eagle friends, let's take a walk down the street where murder meets mystery, a podcast exploring the murderous, the mysterious, and everything that lies beyond the beyond. My name's Trevor. And howdy.
I'm Grace.
We back. Oh, howdy, she's Grace.
Howdy back. We back. Yes.
Holla back.
We're back. Yeah, holla back, cool friends.
Hell yeah. How
no,
back.
Holla back, cool. That was stupid. Can we start over?
No. No, leave it in. Leave it in. It's great.
Every time. I want to start over every time.
Oh, man.
I'm like, wait, I forgot how to be human. Can we start over?
Can we stop? Can we stop for a second?
Anyway, cool friends, we hope you're doing well. We are glad to be back. It was took so long to find a time to record. We just were, I think it was just confusing because we're both busy. And Trevor's got a baby on the way.
I got a baby on the way. I'll inform you on that. But Grace, you had a small saga with your car.
I did, yeah. And I went to pick it up, and they essentially said, we don't know. So.
Which is what you want to hear.
It's good. It's not like it's their job or anything, you know.
Yeah. They gotta freaking figure it out. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the problem is, too, is like because it's making a noise, they can't do anything about it until they replicate the noise. And if there's not anything, my dogs are fighting. So if you hear that, that's what that is. If there's not anything visibly wrong with it or like out of place or something, I was hoping that they just left some tape or something on a part and it was just like spinning around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the car's not even a month old. So like they need to get their shit together.
Yeah. But with it being only a month old, they've got to like kind of do some diagnostic. Some of the field testing is some of the best data. That's how they found recalls and stuff. So.
That's what he was saying is that it's the third car of that make and model and year that has had the problem, a similar problem. So he's saying that like as more data comes out and as time goes on, well, they'll probably know how to fix it. But right now they don't know what's causing it.
Fun.
So I'm like, as long as I know it's safe, like whatever. It's annoying when I'm driving. Like it sounds like the first time it happened, I thought there was a bug in the car. Like it sounded like there was something buzzing around. And I was like, what? I thought there was something trapped in the car. Have you ever had a bee in your car? Terrifying.
I feel like
also humbling because you're in your car. Like,
yeah, it's true. Just swatting
around. Yeah. How are you doing, Trev?
I'm doing good. It's hot.
Yeah.
Summer be heating up.
Yeah.
But in unrelated news, we finished our nursery. Well, we haven't finished it. I painted the nursery last week.
Woo.
For my son.
And, why do you say it like
he's not
going
to get to use it.
Huh? Is that from something?
I don't know. I just felt like saying it like that. It sounded appropriate. It's probably from something. I don't know.
Because that's what you said when you first told me. You were like, I'm going to have a son.
I'm like, I'm having a son.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know. It's just some fatherly instinct, some testosterone hormonal imprint,
right
on my brain for some reason.
Sure.
You know, I honestly think it's just a personification of how I feel.
Truly, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed. Very deep. Anyways.
I'm glad we're all on the same. We're on the same page.
Yeah.
We're
jumping grade levels with that sentence, but anyway.
Yeah. I've got a pretty interesting one today. It is it would be local if you knew where Trevor and I lived. And I guess you'll find out, right?
Yeah, Cooper, cut this out.
we gotta start saying that instead of timestamp. Cooper, cut it out. No. By the way, Google Friends for reference, Cooper is one of our friends. And Trevor and I were joking about having her edit stuff. So Cooper, I know you're listening, babe, and we need an editor because I hate it. So Cooper, cut it.
Depends on if you want to be a super, super duper fan or not. But
yeah,
you know,
exactly. Exactly. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, I guess we're gonna be kind of, what's it called, doxing yourself?
I feel like first names aren't doxing, but they could be.
Well, no, I mean, you're like
talking about like this case.
Yeah, like telling, like this would mean where we went to school, where we live, and where we worked in college.
But it's not an address.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So.
So I don't know. Find me.
Okay.
Fuck around and find out if you really want to.
Okay, let's do it. Michelle. Like amendment. We're going to be talking about a woman named Michelle Young today. Michelle grew up in Sayville, New York. She was the co-captain of the cheerleading team at her high school. She had aspirations to be a tax lawyer. Go off.
Sweet.
And decided to go
sounds
to
North boring.
Carolina. It does, Michelle. Sorry.
Sounds like becoming a government cog.
Yeah, a tax.
Anyways,
sounds like if
unless
I had
you're,
to
unless of, you're arguing with the or against the IRS for people, then okay. You're not a government cog.
Trev, first thing that comes to your mind when I say a job that you would rather die than do this job, go. I said first thing.
Yeah, well, look. Were you gonna have to get into my mind palace for a second? We're gonna have to take you back into the mind palace.
No, dear God, please! I don't want to go in there.
Whenever I'm listening to you, I'm not forming thoughts in my mind palace. So my mind palace is just this giant receptacle for everyone's thoughts.
Uh-huh.
So when I'm listening, I grab them.
See, that makes it sound like you're stupid, and you're not stupid.
No, it means I'm a good listener because I just gather all the.
My mind palace is a big blank void.
When I'm listening.
Mine is closed for renovation. Okay, so job you would hate.
Job I would hate, probably, it would be like being in HR.
Yeah.
I think that would suck because I'd have to one, like put my foot down with people.
Yeah.
And even though sometimes I like think I'd be good at that, I don't think I really am. Being stern with people.
Trev's a teddy bear.
Yes. And two, I wouldn't want to deal with the people who actually make the decisions for HR of like, yeah, well, we're not going to give people a raise because we didn't meet these goals. And it's like, yeah.
Right. Or like firing people. Like my mom has to fire people. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Something worse than a tax lawyer. Go, Grace.
I could first never thing. Be like an accountant or like work in an office like that or like a laboratory somewhere where I don't get to move around and I'm just looking at numbers all day. Like, kill me. That sounds awful.
Yeah, you're one of those standing desk people.
I am a standing desk person. Or I'm a walking pad person. Have you seen those?
Walking pad?
Yes, I want one so bad.
Like for VR?
No, it's a treadmill that like folds up and you lay it flat under your desk and you can stand up at your desk and walk. I want one so bad. They're only like $300. I expected them to be more expensive.
It just sounds like a way for people to try and make, I don't know, bad body decisions. It's like, why are you going to walk all day,
bro? How many calories are you really burning walking at like a...
Burning a ton.
Because you can't be running like lightning while you're working. What are you going to do?
Running versus walking doesn't burn that many more calories. It's only.
But imagine like if you could game and walk at the same time. You'd like.
I would suck at whatever I was playing because I can't focus.
All right. Anyway, so she decided to seek a degree in finance. And so she went to North Carolina State University, which is where Trevor and I attended. College.
Go Pack.
That's where we met as well.
Yeah. Think and do. Go Pack.
I met Trevor when he was 19. That's so weird. Ew.
I don't like the way you said that.
Well,
like you took advantage of me. In our
well, I was also 19.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
To be fair. Yes, and we'll talk.
What's wrong with me?
We'll talk about. We'll talk a little bit about what we did in college, too, because it's a fun time. So, at State, Michelle became a cheerleader and fell in love with Pack football. She eventually gave this up to pursue her studies, and 4 years later, she began her master's in accounting. After college, on her 24th birthday, she met a man named Jason Young at a bar in Raleigh when Jason, another NC State graduate, knocked over her glass of wine.
Wow.
They had a lot in common. Jason had also been involved on campus, working in a job as a resident assistant at an off-campus dorm called University Towers.
No.
So
how recent was this?
That would have been in like early 2000s.
Okay, thank God. I was like,
Yeah, but
worked
that's
where Trevor
and I worked there. Yeah.
Yeah, we did. We worked there
as RAs. We were
long
RAs.
Time as RAs. Yes.
That's how we met. So weird. But we both went to the same. We lived in the same dorm freshman year, but never met each other.
So you mean we lived where a murderer lived? I mean, not jumping ahead, but
you are. But that's okay. He is, yeah.
I can only assume. I don't know, but
you can assume. Yes, that's okay.
Okay, so that's a good
Jason
assumption.
Jason was actually at the time living in his hometown, which was outside of Raleigh, but he was a salesman for Black & Decker and began making sales trips regularly down to Raleigh to sell, but also to see Michelle. That rhymed.
Wow.
Overall, Michelle and Jason seemed crazy about one another, but it was a bit confusing for people because they had two completely different personalities. Jason had kept most of his college immaturity and wanted to party. Some people described him as a classic frat boy, never grew up. He wanted to enjoy the bachelor life, etc. While Michelle was described as very mature, disciplined, and type A. So she was extremely driven.
Yeah, Jason seems like the perfect RA.
Yes. Yeah, he does. We had a few RAs who we worked with who were like that.
Classic. Never give up.
Yeah.
Anyway. The party lifestyle.
Michelle and her mother, Linda, were very close, and they spoke nearly every day on the phone despite living, you know, Linda was in New York and Michelle was in North Carolina still. But there was a lot of tension between Linda and Jason because Linda believed that Michelle deserved much better than Jason. After dating for some time, Michelle became pregnant, or fell pregnant, as we said.
Fell pregnant.
They just said that on a Dateline episode that I just saw, too.
That's one of the things, sorry, not to get philosophical, but the thing about her mother didn't think he was good enough for her. I mean, clearly, given the circumstances why we're talking about this, but also, like, is anyone ever going to be good enough for your child?
No.
So, like, I don't know how I'm going to approach that random step in parenthood, but I got some time before I get there, so.
Yeah, once again, jumping ahead.
Yeah, you know, these are things that we think about in the shower or right before bed anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so after dating for some time, Michelle became pregnant. According to family and friends, Jason was less than excited. It was clear that Jason did not want a child and was not ready for one either.
Party's over.
Yeah, regardless, Michelle had always wanted to be a mom and decided to keep the baby. Jason relented and the couple decided to marry in a civil ceremony in August of 2003. Then Michelle wanted a bigger wedding, so they celebrated the occasion with a traditional ceremony in October of the same year.
Well, that's nice.
Yes. So Michelle was pregnant at their wedding and she gave birth to a beautiful baby girl named Cassidy 5 months after she and Jason got married. Michelle's sister moved down to Raleigh. Her sister's name is Meredith. They were very close. So Michelle's sister moves down to Raleigh to help out with the baby because Jason travels a lot for work.
Right.
And he also is probably not the most involved. I don't know. I don't want to speculate, but based
on his
reaction,
at least he went through with the wedding and he's still in the child's life. So he's made a couple good decisions, but who knows how he feels about all this.
Precisely. Yeah. In March of 2006, Michelle discovers she is pregnant again with the couple's second child, and this time Jason seems overjoyed as this baby was actually planned. 2 months later in May, when the couple was visiting Jason's parents, Michelle and Jason left Cassidy at Jason's parents' house during a visit and went on an errand. Suddenly, Jason drives off the road and down a 100-foot embankment into the French Broad River, and neither is seriously injured.
Oh, wow.
However, just 3 days later, Michelle miscarried. and the couple was devastated. Now, just a few months later, Michelle becomes pregnant again. So, girl is fertile.
Have you seen A Man Called Otto?
No. I've heard that I would like it, though.
That movie messed me up, but there's like a similar... Anyway, I won't spoil it for you because that's like part of the movie, but...
Okay. So I need to watch it?
Yeah. Made me cry.
Oh, God.
It was like hit me in the feels. Like, I cried during A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
Like, especially at the end when, like, she's singing the song after he dies. Spoilers.
Way to go. Come on, Cooper.
Anyway, that one's been out for a long time, okay? So that one's fine. It's free. It's free game if you haven't seen that.
I hadn't seen it. It's fine.
You haven't seen In the Shallow? The Shallow.
I started the movie, but I never finished it. It's okay. Now I know what happened, so I don't have to watch it.
In the Shallow.
What was I going to say? Oh, I cry at every movie, though.
Oh, yeah.
Like, literally. I cried when I saw The Avengers. Don't ask.
I cried a lot more at movies whenever I got married. But then became like, big sap.
Like, good movies just move me to tears.
But The Avengers is whack, though. You can't cry at Marvel movies.
Well, The Avengers isn't like... I don't cry at all Marvel movies. Actually, that's a lie. Movie. I cry at most movies. Seriously.
You're like, in touch with your feelings. I'm getting there.
A movie I did not cry at, because I cried at The Sixth Sense.
Yeah. When Bruce Willis died?
No, when Cole is getting bullied. Like, breaks my heart.
Yeah. Bullying's sad.
And when Toni Collette, like, grabs him and she's like, who's hurting my baby? You know that scene? That made me cry. Okay, anyway.
even though she sounds ridiculous.
Yeah. She's British. So the fact that she does, like, a whatever accent. They live in Philly, but she does a New Jersey accent. They live in
Philadelphia.
Yeah. No, not Philadelphia. Although that would have been a good fatty category.
Yeah, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
It's gas. That's where you get all your gas.
Oh my God, we're focusing now, right? We're ready? Just a few months later, Michelle becomes pregnant again. Jeez.
Big slam.
Slam the door. Yeah. Just a few months later, Michelle becomes pregnant again. Jason is not thrilled, and Michelle doesn't know why. What she didn't know is that what Jason referred to as sales trips weren't sales trips at all.
Wow.
For context, earlier in that year, the couple had a visit from a college friend named Michelle Money, and we'll call her Michelle too. Dateline just called her Money, which cracked me up.
Money.
Michelle too had been complaining to Jason about her own marriage, and Jason took this as a hint, and they began to text constantly.
They started to canoodle.
And they began an affair, yes.
Nah.
As the connection between the lovers deepened, so did Jason's doubts about his marriage to Michelle Michelle. Fast forward to November of that year, so November 2006, Jason has a sales meeting in Clintwood, Virginia. This is an actual sales meeting, not a meeting with money. This is a meeting with money, but not the money that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Cash money.
Not the Michelle money.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
He wasn't making a deposit at the bank of money.
He has a meeting. Ew. He has a meeting in Clintwood, Virginia, which is about 300 miles away. He decides to book in a hotel in Hillsville, which is halfway, about 170 miles away. But it's so what?
Hillsville.
Is that did I say it wrong? Do you know that?
No, place? You said it correctly. I said it.
Okay. Wrong, Hillsville? That's probably Hillsville.
Hillsville.
Yeah, but everyone thought this was really weird, including investigators thought it was suspicious that this was only a 300 mile journey and he booked in a hotel.
Oh.
So it's like that's like a 4-hour drive, right?
Yeah, and Virginia, I don't know, it just depends on how many highways. It could
well,
be,
I guess
even if it was a 5-hour trip, I don't know.
I guess not, because 100 miles, 100 miles is usually 2 hours, right?
Sure.
If you're going highway speeds. My grandpa taught me that. So if you're going highway speeds, one train leaves the station at 5 o'clock. Trauma.
Well, okay, I'm please. Just saying that if, yeah, I mean, you could look at it that way.
So
don't put the trip at like 6 hours.
Right. Anyway, he says goodbye to Michelle and Cassidy and goes out of town on business. Michelle is 20 weeks pregnant.
20 meat.
Michelle is 20 weeks pregnant at this time with the couple's second child, and she has friends over for the evening to watch Grey's Anatomy, including her friend Shelly, I believe. And
Shelly, you have Michelle 2, and Shelly?
I don't know if Michelle 2 was at the Grey's Anatomy viewing, but Shelly definitely is.
Yeah.
So there's just going to be background noise today. Ghoul friends, I don't have my mic. I don't have my headphones, so it's just going to be loud. And my family seems to have forgotten that I'm recording. It's fine.
It happens.
Michelle's friends leave around 10:30 p.m. Michelle and Cassidy go upstairs. They get into PJs, and they settle in for the night. And this is the last time Michelle is seen alive.
Oh, wow.
So
he's supposed to be in Virginia.
Huh?
He's supposed to be in Virginia.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about...
Not that it's him. But...
Yeah. We're going to talk about why his alibi is weird and, like, what happens. And honestly, mm-hmm. like, what I kind of want to do is not a part two, but, like, an extra 10 minutes at the next... on our next episode, because I have... Or I'll do, like, a bonus episode where I read this passage from the book I have on this case, because I haven't finished the book yet. But there's this one section in there where they talk about his alibi and how slim it is. And I can maybe explain it, or I can just kind
and
of...
And you don't have it because you're at your parents' place?
I don't have it because I'm at my parents' house, yeah. So maybe I can do it. I'll just upload a bonus.
You know, you can probably lace the two together in post.
That too. But okay, well, I'll put it here.
Whatever's easiest. Insert book here.
Hey, ghoul friends. Grace on a different day here. I am inserting this audio to just explain kind of the part of the book that I was talking about with the alibi. So here we go. This is from Murder on Birchleaf Drive, The True Story of the Michelle Young Murder Case by Stephen B. Epstein. Okay, so they talk about mainly from the moment of Jason's arrival at the hotel. Now that investigators knew the exact location of Jason's hotel, a group was dispatched to Hillsville, Virginia. They arrived the afternoon of November 4th and began interviewing the hotel manager and staff. To the extent Jason had an alibi, it was the hotel. Investigators therefore wanted to learn everything they could about his arrival on November 2nd, the time of his departure, and everything he did in between. The hotel was 169 miles from the Young's Raleigh home. Detectives had already determined from cell phone records that Jason's phone pinged a cell phone tower in Wytheville, Virginia, 27 miles northwest of Hillsville at 7:40 a.m. on November 3rd. Based on the distance between Hillsville and Raleigh, it would have taken Jason at least 6 hours to drive to Raleigh to commit the murder, return to the Hampton Inn long enough to retrieve the checkout receipt and newspaper, and then to drive on to Wytheville. Investigators needed to confirm the last time he could be placed at the hotel and determine whether that timeline left even the slightest possibility that Jason could have been Michelle's killer. Security video captured by surveillance cameras reveals that Jason first appeared at the hotel's front desk between 10:49 p.m. and 10:51 p.m. on November 2nd. The grainy black and white video showed him wearing a light-colored long-sleeve pullover shirt with buttons from the mid-chest area to his neck. He arrived at his room at 10:56 p.m., which was the only time he used his plastic key card to unlock the door. At 11:59 p.m., security video revealed Jason at the front desk a second time wearing a different shirt, a dark-colored long-sleeve pullover shirt with a light-colored thin stripe across the chest. Less than a minute later, another security camera captured him headed toward the side exit at the western end of the hotel adjacent to a stairwell. That was the last time Jason's presence at the hotel could be documented, right at midnight. That left him a little over 7.5 hours to have driven to Raleigh, committed the murder, returned to Hillsville, and driven as far as Wytheville. Very possible, the detectives reasoned. Additional evidence discovered at the hotel made this scenario even more plausible. At about 5 a.m. on November 3rd, a hotel employee discovered that a small red landscaping rock had been placed in the door jamb at the western emergency exit to prevent the door from closing. I talk about this later in this episode. He kicked the rock out and the door latch closed. There was a sign next to the glass door beside the emergency exit that let guests know that they would need a key card to re-enter the hotel through that door between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. If Jason had wanted to avoid using his key card upon returning to the hotel following the murder, had he anticipated returning prior to 6 a.m., keeping the emergency exit door propped open would certainly have allowed him to do so, therefore enter the building undetected. Another discovery by hotel employees that morning further intrigued investigators. The security camera in the western stairwell, just a few feet from that same emergency exit door, had been unplugged. The last image that camera produced prior to the morning of November 3rd was at 11:20 p.m. on November 2nd, about 20 minutes after Jason entered his room. The camera had apparently been unplugged from then until a hotel employee plugged it back in at 5:50 a.m. on November 3rd. Less than an hour later, however, the same camera was tampered with a second time. From 5:50 a.m. until 6:34 a.m., it appeared to be functioning properly and produced a running stream of video footage of the western stairwell. But at 6:35 a.m., the camera suddenly began capturing footage at the ceiling. When a hotel employee went to investigate the problem, it appeared to him as if someone had shoved the camera upward toward the ceiling. The employee repositioned the camera to face the stairwell, and it worked perfectly well thereafter. If Jason had returned to the hotel at about 6:35 a.m., he would have walked through the glass door without using a key card, pushed the camera toward the ceiling, and taken the stairs to his fourth floor room without being detected. And if he had made sure not to let the door to his room lock when he left the prior evening, he would have re-entered the room without needing his key card to unlock the door. While at the hotel, investigators confirmed it was possible to make the door to room 421 appear to be closed without causing it to lock. The hotel had no record of Jason checking out, but it wasn't uncommon for guests to leave without taking the time to check out at the front desk. Checkout receipts were slipped under guest doors between 3 to 5 a.m. A USA Today newspaper was hung on the outside handle of each guest door in the same time frame. If Jason had returned to the hotel at around 6:35 a.m. after driving back from Raleigh, both would have been there waiting for him. He would have had more than 30 minutes to shower, shave, gather his belongings, and drive the 27 miles to Wytheville by 7:40 a.m. Bear with me, ghoul friends. I know this is a lot, but it's important. There was a significant problem with this theory, however. Math and fuel. Chronologically, the first gas receipt found in Jason's Explorer was from a Handy Hugo near downtown Raleigh at 7:32 p.m. on November 2nd. The second was from a Get It Mart in Duffield, Virginia at 12:06 p.m. on November 3rd. Investigators didn't find any evidence of fuel purchases between those two points in time. Yet it simply wasn't possible for one 22.5-gallon tank of gas, the size of the Explorer's gas tank, to have lasted Jason the 701 miles he would have traveled between 7:32 p.m. on November 2nd and 12:06 p.m. on November 3rd if the investigators' theory was correct. In that time, Jason would have made three 169-mile trips between Raleigh and Hillsville, a 144-mile trip from Hillsville to Clintwood, and a final 50-mile trip from Clintwood to Duffield. Jason's Explorer likely would have run out of fuel before making it back to the hotel the second time. If investigators were going to prove their theory, they had to find a gas station at which Jason had refueled between Raleigh and Hillsville, likely between 4 and 6 a.m. on November 3rd. I will revisit this in this episode. This does happen. So on Monday, November 6th, several sheriff's investigators were dispatched to canvas gas stations along the main highways between Raleigh and Hillsville. Armed with photos of Jason and his Ford Explorer, they spoke with every gas station manager and cashier they could find who was on duty between 4 and 6 a.m. on November 3rd. They were hoping someone would recall a 30-ish-year-old white male in a white Explorer who used cash that morning to buy gas. Miraculously, they hit pay dirt within hours. Gracie Doms Bailey was a cashier at the Four Brothers BP station on Highway 52 in King, North Carolina, just north of Winston-Salem, and about 50 minutes south of the Hampton Inn. She was on duty during the early morning hours of November 3rd. When sheriff's investigators asked whether she remembered a man filling up a white SUV early that morning and paying with cash, she answered without any hesitation. "Yes, I do," she replied. The convenience store worker told investigators a man had pulled up his white SUV to the pump farthest away from the store and repeatedly tried to get the pump to work. When he couldn't, the man came into the store frustrated and angry and cursed at her for refusing to cut the pump on. Bailey explained to him at that time of day, she needed customers to provide identification or cash or a credit card before she was permitted to turn on the pumps. The man threw a $20 bill at her and went back outside while she activated the gas pump. He filled his SUV with only $15 worth of gas and quickly drove off, Bailey said, without returning for his change. Investigators showed her a photograph of Jason. That's the man, Bailey exclaimed. She told them she remembered him vividly because no customer had ever cursed at her like that. His language made such an impression she couldn't forget the early morning incident. As they looked through the store's receipts to confirm her account, the investigators discovered one cash purchase of gas at 5:27 a.m. for $15 and a second at 5:36 a.m. for $20. One of those, they believed, was Jason's. That timing fit neatly within their working timeline, which had Jason tampering with the Hampton Inn's western stairwell security camera about an hour later. More importantly, if Jason had been purchasing gas in King, North Carolina at about 5:30 a.m. on November 3rd, the only logical explanation for his being there was that he was on his way back to the hotel after killing his wife. Okay, thanks for the tangent, girlfriends. Back to the episode. Okay, we're back. So here are the events of the next day. So Meredith, Michelle's sister, gets a call in the morning. I guess it's like late morning. So she gets a call from Jason. And he says, because the couple's third wedding anniversary is coming up, he says that he's been looking for a purse online for Michelle. And he finds this purse that she's been wanting. He finds it on eBay. And he accidentally sent a copy of the online listing to Michelle's email or faxes it to her or something. So he asks Meredith to go over and get the listing before Michelle sees it.
Oh, okay.
Very strange, but whatever. No one questioned it. She entered the home through a side door in the garage, which was always kept unlocked. Meredith recalls walking in the home and immediately feeling uneasy because this is around one in the afternoon, mm-hmm. and the house is dead quiet.
Right. That's never good.
None of the lights are on. The house is really cold because someone didn't turn the heat on.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's really cold in there and it's quiet. And Michelle's purse and keys are there, meaning she's home. But she doesn't hear Cassidy. She doesn't hear Michelle. Nothing. The only thing she can hear is the family dog whimpering upstairs.
Oh, no.
So this is pretty grim, girlfriends. Just warning.
It's not looking good.
Meredith goes up the stairs to discover Michelle lying in a pool of her own blood in the master bedroom. She sees a baby doll lying near Michelle's head and hears shuffling behind her as baby Cassidy crawls out from under the bed.
Oh.
She was dressed in clean pajamas but seemed lost and confused. So Meredith calls 911 from the Young residence at 5108 Birchleaf Drive at 1:30 p.m. She's frantic, explaining that her sister Michelle is lying face down in a pool of blood in her bedroom. She tells the dispatcher, quote, "There's like bloody footprints all over the house, like her daughter's little footprints. I think my sister's dead."
Aww.
Paramedics, I want to pause and talk about this 911 call. Maybe I'll link it, maybe I won't. I'll probably forget, whatever. Cooper, link it. But she, the 911 call is like a little weird to me. And we don't have any reason to suspect the sister, but the 911 call is very strange. And no one talks about it. Like she's, for one, the paramedic is like, or the dispatcher is like, how old is she? And she goes, she's 28, 29. Weird. And she's also so calm. So calm. I don't know.
It is weird. And she's also gotten like tipped off and she's the one supposed to find her and all that. But also like she could just be in a weird state of shock.
Yeah, because I do wonder if
she's necessarily in on everything, but
this is another reason why people suspect Jason is because he called Meredith and it's like maybe he just needed the body to be found at a certain time so that his alibi lined up.
Yeah.
We don't know. So anyway, paramedics arrive and find Michelle Young dead from blunt force trauma after being hit at least 10 times in the head. They seal off the house as a crime scene. Blood is spattered on the walls and covering the bed and floor. Michelle had suffered brain bruising, swelling, and bleeding, as well as several fractures and the loss of several teeth. So this is a violent, violent attack. There are signs of a struggle, and Michelle is discovered holding fistfuls of her own hair, having apparently torn them out during the attack.
Ouch.
It gives me chills. Ugh.
Yeah.
Cassidy Young, just 2.5 years old, is discovered at the scene, having tracked bloody footprints over most of the upstairs, including the bathroom. And she appeared to have... Oh, I'll get to that part in a sec. The footprints belong to Cassidy, as well as an unknown assailant with a size 12 men's shoe.
Mm-hmm.
Cassidy had apparently tried to comfort her mother by bringing her the doll, which is what she left at Michelle's head.
That's sad.
And then toddled into the bathroom where she attempted to wash her hands, smearing blood on the wall and tracking it through the upstairs hallway. She was otherwise unharmed. So,
oh, that's so sad.
None of the blood was hers, but she was with her mom's body for, I mean, they have to assume ever since she was killed. So like six hours.
Yeah. Or potentially, afterwards. But yeah. It's weird to know, like, so if you have a child that's old enough to walk, I just learned this because we assembled our crib this past weekend. In the crib, you can take down, like, one of the bars, like, on the sides and put up a little, like, it's almost like a little door. It's like it cuts it in half to where one side is open so the kid can, like, shimmy on out of the bed and, like, walk around. And that can be, like, their first little toddler bed. And so if they ever have, like, a nightmare or something, they can run in and jump on your chest and be like, wah. But they're, like, able to get out of the crib at that point.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it was, like, she was put to bed and then heard a commotion, was either curious or scared, stayed in her bed until the guy left. Or the assailant, I don't know, guy. But it stayed until he left and then eventually found her mom, either when she woke up or during or after.
I don't know, she must have heard it, you know.
She could have, especially if there were signs of a struggle. I doubt it was quiet.
Yeah.
But.
So on November 8th, 2006, so this is 2 days later, Jason Young responds to a court order for his blood and DNA samples as well as his fingerprints. By this time, the case has attracted national coverage and appears in CBS News, People Magazine, and Fox News, to name a few sources. Michelle's family buries her on November 9th, 2006, and within a week, Sheriff's Office has released the house as a crime scene. The case seemingly goes cold, with Jason having been out of town and cleared of guilt, and Michelle's sister having no apparent motive, but the suspicion of Jason never wanes. Michelle's family seems convinced of his guilt, and in October of 2008, her mother files a wrongful death suit against Jason Young. December 2nd, 2008, after Jason's non-response to the suit, Linda Fisher wins a default judgment against Jason, and the court rules in her favor, which kind of starts the whole trial.
Oh.
On December 5th, 2008, ruling in the wrongful death suit, Superior Court Judge Donald Stevens finds that Jason Young willfully and unlawfully killed his wife and therefore bars Jason Young from collecting life insurance on his wife. So this is what starts the... It basically determines that the death was under suspicious circumstances. So it's going to... Yeah. He is officially a suspect in the murder of his wife.
Right, so it's basically all this has gone forward to, like, go ahead and stop him from getting the life insurance, but this is also...
Right,
like,
I'm sure that's part of it,
properly accusing him of committing a criminal offense.
She's also... Linda is convinced that Cassidy's in the wrong hands, because Cassidy obviously goes to her father.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She's like, Linda's freaking out because she's like, he doesn't deserve to have the child.
Right, especially if he killed her mother.
Yeah. So she files an custody complaint.
Rip.
An official custody complaint that alleges that Jason Young had consistently denied them telephone and personal contact. That's true. and that he has posted photos of Cassidy on the internet in attempts to get dates.
Ew.
Yuck, right? Also,
single dad is, life.
Yeah, the statement that she makes about the withholding contact is true. So basically, after the murder, Jason takes Cassidy to his parents' house, like 100 miles away, and doesn't let them see her or talk to her on the phone. So that's Linda crazy. And Meredith are cut off from their granddaughter and their niece.
And like, what
probably because
what motivation do you have to do that if your wife was murdered unjustly?
Right. And that's what I'm saying. Like, unless you had something to do with it, but part of that shows like his immaturity too, you know?
Right.
So let's get to the investigation. So the biggest thing that I'll be talking about is Jason's alibi, which I told you a little bit about earlier. I'm going to insert that part from the book, but anyway, so the next morning, Jason makes several phone calls. I believe the number I remember is 8 phone calls. I could be wrong about that. Like right in a row. It doesn't tell us what number he was calling, but he made 8 phone calls around 7:30 a.m. and none of the calls lasted more than 10 seconds.
Oh, wow.
So the calls may have been to Michelle.
None of them ever lasted more than 10 seconds. It's crazy.
I don't know. My guess is that he was calling Michelle and then hanging up and calling her and then hanging up to make it appear, assuming that he's guilty, because legally he is.
Right.
Assuming that he's guilty, he would be doing that in order to see if she's answering or make it appear that that's what he's doing.
Yeah, well.
I don't know. So.
It's weird.
He shows up at his sales meeting 30 minutes later. And then he goes to his parents' house afterwards as planned. So one of the things the police did to kind of track his movements was they checked his payments at gas stations.
It's like, I don't want to be tracked.
Right. So Jason claims he covers more miles than he claimed, basically. We know that because he put $15 worth of gas in his car when to get to his parents' house, he only would have needed $5 or whatever. Like it was something like that. Where there was a discrepancy
in the amount of gas he needed versus the gas he was driving in the more tank than versus like, right.
Yes. So, and you know, $15 worth of gas at that time was probably a full tank of gas.
He could have
gone 100 miles and back.
2006.
So, I mean, it was $2, probably $2.50. Yep.
$2.
Yeah.
Like $2.30.
So he's in an Explorer, like an old Explorer. So he's probably, drive there 170 miles.
I mean, if he started off with a full tank, he could probably get there.
Yeah. And then he had to fill up on the way back.
Yeah. It's crazy. The gas prices in 2006 in January were $2.36.
Well, I remember the first time I filled up the tank in my car, like when I was like 16, the first time I filled up my car, it was $2.98.
Dang. It's crazy to think that the gas prices are still like around that price.
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, now they're like $3.98.
Nah, it's $3.29 today when I filled up, but.
Really? Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
There was like a random week in May that they were super low. It was like $2.60 and then it went back up.
Yeah, it's crazy. There was a peak in like June 2008 at $4.10. And then recently we beat that at like the peak was in like June of 2022. It was like $5 per gallon.
And it was like $5.29, yeah.
Isn't that insane? I always thought there was like a larger gas price hike.
Well, wasn't there a leak or something? Or a spill?
Yeah, probably something.
I don't remember. There's like who really knows, you know? There's no way to know.
So in June 2008, it was a $4.10. And then December and or January 2009, it was $1.84. Like, why?
It's so weird.
It was like right after the election.
The economy, like... Yeah, no idea. Okay, so, like I said, he covers more miles than he claims. No evidence suggests any other suspects, and the only evidence against Jason is circumstantial.
Right.
Because they weren't able to tie him with DNA. And the closest thing to like physical evidence was that he owned a pair of hiking boots that matched the footprint.
Oh, come on.
But there was no trace of blood found on his shoes.
Okay.
Or they couldn't find the shoes. I don't remember. But
yeah, no, that's crazy. So it's still a cold case?
No, we'll get there. So since no evidence suggests other suspects, and I still don't really understand how he was convicted, there's like a whole team of people who are like free Jason Young because they think he was wrongfully accused and convicted.
Right.
But Cassidy's living with Jason, and this puts a lot of stress on Michelle's family. Jason is finally arrested as a result of the custody suit. Jason is arrested.
So they sued him to get custody of their grandchild.
So she files the wrongful death suit, and then she says, okay, because this suit is active, Keish is not fit as a father, and the court agrees. So they come and get him. They arrest him. And now it takes 2 years for the prosecution to build a case against Jason, and at that point in time, he's out on bail, but he's no longer in custody of Cassidy.
Gotcha.
He's still proclaiming his innocence. In June of 2011, Jason has his first trial, ending in a mistrial because the evidence was too circumstantial and it was led to a hung jury, which that term cracks me up every time.
Hung jury.
Hung jury. Yeah. I'm like, wow. Jury was packing heat, man.
Yeah.
For the second trial in February of 2012, the prosecution builds an even stronger case, and neighbors claim to have seen a white car. So they actually have witnesses. Neighbors claim to have seen a white car in Michelle's driveway. The night of the murder. Also, Cassidy's kindergarten teacher testifies, saying that since the murder, she's observed some troubling behavior with Cassidy and how she plays with dolls.
Oh, wow.
So here are some of the words that she's used, Cassidy. Quote, mommy's getting a spanking for biting.
Oh.
Quote, mommy has boo-boos all over. And quote, mommy has red stuff all over. Isn't that creepy?
That's weird to just how a child that small tries to
And then obviously the footprints there's a lot of research that suggests that the way children play with dolls is like how they're treated or how they've seen others be treated.
Wow.
Like children that are rough with their dolls, usually something's going on.
Yeah, like they're just like not imprinting, but mimicking the behavior that they're observing or is being done to them.
Exactly. Yeah.
It sounds crazy.
Yeah, it's so interesting. That's why I love developmental psychology. It's like it's all that stuff. So, like I said, the footprints match the pair of shoes that Jason bought the year before, but those I don't really know if it's definitive enough because he has those shoes, but so do other people. So it's not like. It's not damning evidence.
Yeah.
Statements are made by friends and family, including Michelle Money, against Jason. And they claim a history of physical abuse and a tumultuous relationship between the two, which makes sense of the spanking thing.
Yeah.
Now, that also, by the way, may have been Cassidy's interpretation of a beating. And she just thought she didn't know the difference, which is possible.
Exactly.
But for all intents and purposes, Jason wanted out and didn't want to be a father. Despite the case being relatively loose, the jury found Jason guilty and sentenced him to life without the possibility of parole. So many pieces of evidence, all circumstantial and none of them tangible proof, the murder weapon was never found. According to Coffee House Crime, which is a YouTuber, may have talked about him. Yeah.
I like him.
Yeah.
I watched him a lot before I, started this. I like his videos.
Yeah, he's a British dude with like startlingly blue eyes. He reminds me of Jordan for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. Jason, I like it. His videos are short and nice.
Yeah. Jason was a selfish individual who hated his marriage. He envisioned his former life to be one in a cage, and the decisions he made to get out of this would lead him to finding another one, to finding another life, leaving Cassidy without a mother, Linda without her daughter, and Meredith without a sister. Cassidy is currently being raised by her aunt Meredith and the rest of Michelle's family, and Michelle Young was loved by those around her. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, I like his little summaries up of like
yeah,
the, crimes that he covers.
I just love his accent.
Yeah, go check out Coffeehouse Crime, Cool Friends.
Yeah,
pretty nice if you like true crime.
Yeah, or if you just like, I don't know, if you're like me and you fall asleep to true crime, you're like, it's very calming.
You're like a British gentleman with blue eyes, or yes, wherever exactly. He's from.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm ready for you, Trev.
He might be Australian.
No, I think he's British.
Yeah. I don't know. Whatever. You know, whatever. He's got a cool accent.
Yeah. I think his accent is from, he's from like South London, which is why he sounds like that. Cool. He has a London accent because he sounds like, he sounds like Daniel Radcliffe. It's the same accent. And Daniel Radcliffe's from London, so.
Yeah, he sounds like Harry.
Which, fun fact, Great Britain is one of the most linguistically diverse regions in the entire world. Very interesting. Makes sense. Yeah, there's like 40 different accents in one place. Yeah.
Being kind of central to the world if you look at it on a map.
Yeah.
But not on a sphere. Anyway.
Anyway.
Anyway, but yeah, no, and their national dish is like tikka masala and stuff, so like they're very diverse and stuff.
I thought you said national dick is dis.
I did. I tried to cover it up by accident.
National dick is.
I meant to say dish, but I said national dish dishes. Okay. Why am I
mushroom? By the way, today I read a short story with one of my students, and the author's name was Richard Dick.
Richard Dick.
So his name is Dick Dick.
Yeah. Dick Dick.
Isn't that weird? Like, did no one think that through?
Or
did
they do that? Why is Richard Dick familiar to me? Probably because it's Richard Dick.
He wrote Minority Report.
Okay.
Okay.
That's probably what it's from. It honestly, the name probably stuck with me, and I didn't know why.
Minority Report is such a good movie. It has Tom Cruise, but he wrote. It's based on a short story where basically this guy. It's a dystopian future where the people. I don't remember what the crime unit is called, but it's a unit of special police that prevents crimes by using artificial intelligence to detect crimes before they're committed and arresting people.
Oh.
Very interesting.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it is cool. Okay, your turn.
Are you ready?
Yes.
So we have a little bit of a mysterious conspiracy on our hands today, or a mysterious phenomenon. I don't know. I think it's cool. Cooper actually recommended this a day ago. She texted me. She was like, "Do I have the mystery for you, my friend?" And I was like, "Okay,
wow."
And today we're going to be talking about
something
that you and I are going through right now.
Oh.
Currently is we're going to talk about the 27 Club. You ever heard of the 27 Club?
No.
Well, it's not something you want to join. Because the 27 Club is an informal list consisting mostly of popular musicians, artists, actors, and other celebrities who died at age 27. And the phenomena is that a lot of musicians, popular people, celebrities, there's like a higher statistical amount of people who die at the age of 27.
Heath Ledger.
I don't know.
Oh.
He's not in my notes.
I can check. Let me Google it.
And there was a list on the thing. I can check. Well, I've got a list of other people, but Heath Ledger just wasn't on my list. But it's in alphabetical, so.
He was born in 1979 and died in 2008.
I don't think that's quite it. No, it is, isn't it?
I'm so bad at calculating ages. Oh, he was 29. Damn. Okay. Damn. Anyway, go ahead.
But good for him. He didn't join the club. Anyway. So, beginning with the deaths of several 27-year-old popular musicians between 1969 and 1971, dying at the age of 27 came to be and also remains a subject of popular culture because of those deaths in 1969 and 1971. Those people that died then were Brian Jones, Brian Jones was a founder of the Rolling Stones and the lead guitarist of the Rolling Stones before he died in 1969, I think, or between 69 and 71. Jimi Hendrix, which should be familiar with him, influential electric guitarist and singer-songwriter. Janis Joplin.
Wow.
So she's very well known for her stage presence and powerful vocals, and a singer-songwriter from that time. Both they all died between 1969 and 71. And one more, Jim Morrison, also died during that age. And they all died at the age of 27.
I get him and Van Morrison confused.
Yeah, I think Van Morrison's still alive, isn't he?
Van Morrison is Brown Eyed Girl, but I don't know his.
I'm not sure, but Jim Morrison was the lead Doors. Vocalist for the Doors, yeah.
Yes, okay.
He's also a poet, fun fact, but anyway. And an individual doesn't necessarily have to be a musician to qualify as a member of the 27 Club. But basically, this cultural phenomenon attributes special significance to popular people, celebrities, that died at the age of 27, often as a result of drug and alcohol abuse, or violent means such as homicide, suicide, or weirdly, like transportation related accidents, like car crashes, plane crashes, stuff like that. One of the earliest popular musicians to be included in the list of the 27 Club members was blues musician Robert Johnson, who died in 1938. Do you happen to know what Robert Johnson is famous for?
No, but I'm sure I would know the song or whatever.
So it's not a song, but it's actually a legend. And this, according to legend, a young man living on a plantation in rural Mississippi, Johnson, had a tremendous desire to become a great blues musician. Okay. And one of the legends often told, but you know, spread word of mouth, was that Robert Johnson was instructed to take his guitar to a crossroad near Dockery Plantation at midnight in Mississippi, which was just like some sort of crossroads or, you know, like busy place. And there are claims for other like crossroads that he could have been, but the legend says that it was near Dockery Plantation specifically, which is like an actual like landmark that you can go visit. But whenever he got there at midnight, he was met by a large black figure who is reportedly to be the devil, who took the guitar and tuned it. And then the devil played a few songs, then returned the guitar to Robert Johnson, giving him mastery over the instrument, to then which he invented like the earliest forms of like blues and rock and roll.
That's so cool.
So, and this story is basically the story of the deal with the devil at the crossroads. And it mirrors the legends of like Faust, like the German, I don't know if it's a folktale Faust, but in Faust, there's like a scholar, a scientist or whatever, who becomes depressed and attempts to take his own life. And then basically he stops because he calls on the devil to give him all the knowledge of and pleasure in all the world. And in response to that, the devil's like, yeah, that's fine. But like, you're going to have to give me your soul after a while of having this knowledge. So it's kind of like a,
give me your soul.
It's a bit of a, like, that's where we think like some smart person from the area that knew Robert Johnson kind of made all this up, given ties to the Faust story.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. But that he apparently died when he was 27 as well.
Wow. Okay. Robert Johnson, not Faust.
Robert Johnson. Yeah. Faust is is the subject of like the story, who's like a fictional character.
Oh, got it. Okay.
But that's what it was like based upon, was the German folktale or German.
Is it like tale? Anansi?
Anansi the spider?
Uh-huh.
I think so.
Okay. Got it.
And so I think it's cool, but that's what Robert Johnson's famous for, inventing rock and roll as we know, I think. He also died at the age of 27.
What? Faust?
No, wait. Robert Johnson.
Oh, okay. I understand you were wrapping it up. Got it. Okay. Yeah, I was like, what did I miss? Okay.
The overarching theme, which I'm going to repeat a lot. Yes. So everybody be dying at the age of 27.
Got it. Got it.
Which except is us. How old I am.
Yes, and me, too.
And you.
That's so wild.
Mm-hmm. So
ew, I hate
I'll
it.
I'll be out of that 27 club window in a couple months.
Oh.
Just stay alive, Grace. That's all we got to do. Stay alive.
Yes, I know. So close.
I mean, we're technically celebrities with this podcast. So.
True. So true. Yeah.
This applies to us. Drive safe. Get your car checked out. Call your dad. Get your paps.
I did, yeah.
Rolling Stone included television actor Jonathan Brandis, who committed suicide in 2003, in a list of the 27 Club members. I don't know if you would know who that was. I included it because you're good with actors, but he's not like a current actor.
Ronald Brandis?
Jonathan Brandis.
No, I don't know who that is.
Do you know who Anton Yelchin is?
No.
Okay, well, he had played in a punk rock band, but was primarily known as a film actor, and he was also a member of his club upon his death in 2016. Another person that you may know is, like, Jean-Michel Basquiat. Like, the painter, I think.
That's probably John.
Like, people who have, I think he's a high-end painter, is what a Basquiat painting is.
American artist who rose to success during the 1980s as part of the neo-expressionism movement.
Right.
Okay. Jean-Michel Basquiat.
I think it's pronounced Basquiat.
It's probably Basquiat or something like that. We don't realize.
Who knows? But he's included in the 27 Club. Even though he was just a prominent painter, musician, it happens. One person you probably know, and this is the most recent person of note. There's been other people that
Mac Miller.
No.
Oh, damn.
Miller, no. Unless he's, we'd have to check on him.
Mac Miller, I think, was like 25, actually. I think he was younger.
Yeah, he wasn't in my notes. But that doesn't mean he wasn't. I just didn't comb the list specifically looking for him. But if you want to side goog, that'd be good. But hold on to your seats.
Oh, he's 26. Okay.
Yeah, so he's close. But do you remember Benjamin Keogh? He was Elvis Presley's grandson and was one of the more recent people. He committed suicide on July 12th, 2020 at the age of 27. Which was, was it Jamie Lynn Presley?
Yes. Lisa Marie Presley.
Lisa Jamie Marie Lynn Presley
is not a person.
No, not a person. But yeah, that was her son.
Jamie Lee Curtis or Jamie Lynn Spears.
Bro.
I know who you meant, though.
There's no telling. My mind palace, as you
Riley, heard, is just a so Riley vessel. Keough. Riley Keough is a celebrity and singer who was just in Daisy Jones and the Six. So for anyone who's read that book and seen the show.
So that might have been her his younger
sister. I think it was her brother. Yeah.
Okay. Crazy.
Yeah.
But another person to add fuel to the conspiracy of the 27 Club is Kurt Cobain.
Oh, yeah.
We have a couple of things about from a biographer here. But according to Hendrix, so he wrote a biography for him, Hendrix and Kurt Cobain. The biographer, Charles R. Cross, he according to him, like the growing importance of the media, internet, magazines, and television, and the response to an interview of Cobain's mother were jointly responsible for the 27 Club constantly coming back up and also fueled people for more people to know about it and more people to like freak out and conspire with it.
Well, he's probably the biggest celebrity. Yeah. He was probably the biggest celebrity that you've talked about so far besides maybe Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. I think combination of Kurt Cobain being such a large celebrity. And I think what he's saying here, what Cross is saying here is like that. And also the freedom of the more information from the internet, magazines, television being more widespread, that this theory about the 27 Club was able to spread farther because people were like, oh man, Kurt Cobain died. And then some people were saying, yeah, he's part of the 27 Club. And then that got sent around.
Yeah.
It's more of a conspiracy. at that time because it was more easily accessible information.
Gotcha.
To learn about the conspiracy. But the, I mean, his mother kind of did it to him as well because, you know, it, this would have been something hot to watch on television. It would have been super breaking, super big breaking news. But in one of an expert from a statement that Cobain's mother, which I didn't know her name was this long, Cobain's mother is Wendy Freidenberg Cobain O'Connor.
Okay.
Which, all right, is that she said, now he's gone and joined that stupid club. I told him not to join that stupid club. And we're thinking that she's referring to Hendrix, Joplin, Morrison dying all at the same age. So we thought right. that she's hinting at the 27 Club. But she said that in an interview. Isn't that wild?
That is wild.
Which kind of further pointed people to be like, what club is she talking about?
Where is she talking about? I mean, way to go, icon. Get people talking, for sure.
Yeah, it's wild. On the other hand, there was another writer of the Times. His name was Eric Segalstad. He wrote The 27s, colon, The Greatest Myth of Rock and Roll. That's kind of like, give us the opposing
views. So it's here. Mainly musicians, it sounds like rock and roll artists.
It seems like they're trying to paint it that way. It's not necessarily the case in other times because certain people, I mean, if you die and you're 27, you're a celebrity, people are like, oh, 27 Club.
But you can also be related to a rock musician like Benjamin Keough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is weird, but Eric is saying that he assumes that Cobain's mother was referring to the death of his two uncles and his great uncle, all of whom had committed suicide. So he's thinking that she didn't want him to join the club of committing suicide. It seems such a weird way to put anything.
Yeah.
But she's grieving. I'm not going to judge her.
Yeah, that's fair. Right after me saying, what a weirdo.
Yeah. Well, whoops. I mean, it is a weird way to say things. So you're
not that wrong. Is weird.
According to Cross again, the guy who wrote the biography, the events had led to a set of conspiracy theorists to suggest that the absurd notion that Kurt Cobain intentionally timed his death so he could join the 27 Club, which I'm not going to go that far. I think he's just doing that to make his book sound controversial or interesting, maybe. I don't think Kurt Cobain meant to die, but
yeah, what the fuck, anyway, Kurt?
That's another conspiracy for another day, I believe.
True. That's a messed up one. Like we talked about, some of these conspiracies can like hurt people, you know, like that's
they can
up.
Hurt people. And then also, so that's one of the sad parts. And I don't try to get into that too much, but it's interesting to kind of go down the rabbit hole and come out the other side and be like, that was fun, but I don't necessarily believe it. You kind of have to drink the conspiracy Kool-Aid to believe some of these things. But that being said, the mystery surrounding Kurt Cobain's death is an interesting one. It's kind of like our Bruce Lee episode that you did.
Yeah.
It's just there's a lot of random details that are definitely very strange.
Yeah, he died with a shotgun, right? Yeah.
He committed suicide via a shotgun. And then there's just a lot of weird things with, like, Courtney Love.
Mm-hmm.
With Courtney Love. And then also, like, the actual crime scene evidence, there was a lot of different locked doors that he couldn't have unlocked or locked himself. Like, he was locked in a room that you could only lock from the outside.
That's weird. Yeah.
Anyway, there's your teaser, girlfriends. Either me or Grace will do that one, because it's a wild ride. I remember hearing about it. So.
I have a few musicians I want to talk about, so I could maybe do like a Florida Man, but I'll do suspicious celebrity deaths.
Hell yeah. Well, maybe so, but we'll talk about it. We definitely should cover Kurt Cobain at some point, but
yeah.
Yeah, cool friends. So he's on there, but I want to talk about another phenomena that kind of goes hand in hand with this 27 Club. Grace, have you ever heard of the White Lighter Curse?
Mm-mm.
Or White Lighter Myth? Where, like, you get, like, a Bic lighter, and if it's white, people don't want it.
Oh, why not?
Well, it is an urban legend based on the 27 Club.
Hmm.
In basically several musicians and artists allegedly, or it claims that they died while in possession of a white disposable cigarette lighter, leading to that becoming associated with like bad luck, especially if you're 27.
Weird. Okay.
And that myth is primarily based upon the deaths of Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, and Kurt Cobain, which it claims were all
holding a white lighter or carrying.
All in possession of a white lighter. And then
weird.
That's like, it's kind of like a superstition that is among like cannabis users. I don't know how else to say that. It's like a
weed smokers.
Yeah, it's like a wives' tale for weed
stoners?
Smokers.
How about stoners?
It's a weed wife tale.
Oh.
Wide weaves tale. You know what I'm saying? Anyway,
Yeah, Benjamin Keough was Riley Keough's sister.
Riley Keough was Benjamin Keough's sister.
Right.
I mean, we don't know. Anyway.
True.
So that isn't my take. I don't necessarily think the lighter or like the Kurt Cobain tried to kill himself to be in the club, but and there's another giant opinion here that just screams opinion from music biographer Cross. He said the number of musicians who passed away at 27 is truly remarkable by any standard. Though humans die regularly at all ages, there's a statistical spike for musicians who die at 27. Now, I don't know if he did the actual statistics, but
yeah,
there was a study done by the British Medical Journal in December of 2011.
Okay.
And it concluded, so here's kind of like the facts, maybe, or the science, maybe you decide. There's a caveat to this whole statistical analysis.
Yeah.
The medical journal concluded that there was no increase in the risk of death for musicians at the age of 27 per se, but there were also equally small increases of risk of death at ages 25 and 32 for musicians. So they didn't find any statistical evidence for the age of 27, but there were like equal risk of death increases at 25 and 32. Which was weird.
Okay.
But these are statistics. They're a little honky sometimes. The study noted that... Yeah. Honk, honk. Wonky, honky. It's all the same to me. That same study noted that young adult musicians have a higher death rate than the general young adult population. Which kind of logically makes sense. They surmise that fame may increase the risk of death among musicians, but this risk is not limited to age 27. That was basically their conclusion. A little bit of like backstory to that. So that was the British Medical Journal, keyword British. The selection criteria for the musicians included in that study, based on having scored a UK number one album. So they had to be in the UK number one spot from 1956 to 2007. So the several notable things about that is that members of the 27 Club, including popular or more well-known members of the 27 Club that didn't have a number one album between 1956 and 2007, included Jimi Hendrix, Joplin, Morrison, Pete Ham, and Ron Pigpen McKernan. So all those were like people that never got to the number one spot on the UK album charts, but were still a part of the 27 Club. So there's like six, or what, how many is that? Five data points right there that could have skewed the statistics if they had opened it up to like maybe top Billboard charts or something, depending on how they organized their data, which is very interesting. So
yeah, this seems very... I don't know. Honky.
It does seem honky. It's like, yeah, well, you can make statistics mean anything you want if you use the right data set. And it's not necessarily fudging the numbers. You're just presenting the statistics as fact because they make sense. But it all depends on what data set you use.
Right.
So, I mean, if you use the number one album from the 1950s to now for Zimbabwe, it probably wouldn't include half the people in the entire world. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
So it's
conflating. Is that what they call it?
Yeah, conflating.
False,
it's like
false correlation.
Potentially, like their statistics might be correct based upon their
data.
But
it doesn't seem.
But it doesn't. It's not indicative of like the entire world. It's only indicative of the UK.
Right. Like they. Well, they say the same thing about like the statistic that we always studied in psych is the like murders in the UK and ice cream sales in India are correlated. But that doesn't mean they're related or cause. No, correlation does not equal causation, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm with you on that one. But yeah, so I'm going to need some more data. You know, I need them to open that data set up to like, I don't know, all musicians that had not just a number one album, but I'm saying like a number one song.
Yeah.
Why has it got to be an album? Anyway, well, I think that would be interesting.
Cause, more I mean, of an accomplishment, I suppose.
Yeah, and you open that up, like, there's so many musicians that go over the Billboard charts, you know, and they, I think if you get a number one song, you're at least decently popular to be in the 27th Club.
Mm-hmm.
So. But,
when did, what about Amy Winehouse?
Oh, yeah, Amy Winehouse, I might have jumped over here, her by accident. Yeah, I did. So, Amy Winehouse was on it as well. She's another notable one.
Let me see. I was going to say Selena, but she died at 23. That's so young. Oh my God.
There was a ton of people that I was like, is this person on here? And then they weren't, but I was like, oh, that's so sad. It was like, they weren't on there because they died younger or they died.
Yeah.
29, which is still young. Anywhere that's around. Still too young. Still
yeah.
Too young.
Yeah.
Yeah, she died in 2011 from alcohol poisoning. And she was 27 years and 312 days old.
312 days old, okay. So almost 28.
Right. Yeah, crazy stuff, though.
I'm Googling it. Yeah. That's so weird. Such a strange, like, specific, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sure it sounds like I'm recording this in like a coffee shop, but it's just my parents talking in the background. I don't know. Can you hear that?
I feel like
you're being really loud, but
I don't hear it.
Okay. All right. Cool.
But yeah, I have one more thing, which kind of ties it all in because we always talk about stuff like this.
Okay.
But it's, well, and it's also my favorite band, but anyway, the name of the song 27 by Fall Out Boy from their 2008 album, Folie à Deux.
What did you say? Album.
Album. But yeah, the album's named Folie à Deux. Or Folie à Deux from From what was the one where they all died in the house with scarves?
Yeah.
Chifani, no.
Nope. The Barari deaths.
Barari deaths. That's it.
Yep. I didn't even need to look it up.
But that song is a reference to the 27 Club, where the lyrics explore the hedonistic lifestyles common in rock and roll, which, you know, probably doesn't, or probably contributes to people dying early, but anyway.
That's what some people believe anyway, yes.
Some people believe. Pete Wentz thought so. The primary lyricist of Fall Out Boy wrote the song because he felt that he was living a similarly dangerous lifestyle as to the people who were in the 27 Club.
Huh. Okay. Weird.
Yeah, but that's all I got. The 27 Club.
Wow. That was scary.
Coincidence or natural phenomena?
Wow, both.
Hopefully, probably. I don't find out either. Whether
yeah,
either
no, let's make it to 28. Deal?
Yeah. Here's the 28, Grace. Let's go.
28 Club.
Fist in the air. Finger to the sky. Glass in hand.
Wow,
we don't
well,
want to die.
Job.
Anyway, there it is.
Good job, Trev. Cool friends.
Thanks.
Wow, what a fun one.
Wow.
Wow.
Cool friends, wow.
Yeah,
thanks for joining us for another one, Cool Friends. I hope you enjoyed the 27 Club, and I hope you enjoyed the murder case or case of Michelle Hit him with Grace, Michelle Young.
And make sure to follow us on Instagram at Where Murder Meets Mystery.
Like, rate, comment, and subscribe
on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe.
Subscribe, you know, anything. Just if you see us, give us, do the thing.
Click that like button, blah, 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 blah.
If you see us, do the thing. I don't know. Just interact, do something.
We can't wait to hear from you. Call your dad. Get your paps.
Send us any ideas for podcasts. We love
them. And wash your hands, as Scarlett said. Yes, please, for the love of God, send us requests. Cooper can't do it all, you guys.
Yeah, Cooper's showing you all up. This is probably like the 18th thing she sent me.
That's so true. Cooper's like the most involved fan.
She's the OG.
Well, to be fair, I have not done the only case she's ever requested for me because it's so dark and scary.
Because it hurts.
Yeah, it hurts. Anyway, okay. We are all done for today, yeah?
Yep. Have a good week, cool friends. We'll see you on the next episode. Bye.
Bye, we love you.